Hello and welcome everyone to this week's edition of Truth to Power. I'm Justin Mogg, one of the programmers here on Forward Radio. Joining me in the virtual studio for this weekly community conversation once again is Hart Hagen of Let's Talk and the Climate Report, which you can hear every day of the week at 7 p.m. on this station. Welcome, Hart.
Hello.
Good to have you here via Zoom and also in the virtual studio. We're safely physical distancing, but we are not social distancing today. We are going to have a great conversation with Stephen Bartlett. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you. It's great to be with y'all.
Stephen's been on these airwaves before. He's a director of Forward Radio's community partner, in fact, Sustainable Ag of Louisville, Sol. You can learn more about Sol at SALouisville.org. He's also an active member of the Black Lives Matter movement. I've certainly seen him out on the Freedom Fridays ride against mass incarceration and protesting ICE. Stephen's actively involved in international solidarity work and in farm workers' rights. And one project that he's also involved in is the Common Earth Gardens. And we're going to talk a bunch about that today. You want to quickly give an overview of what that is, Stephen?
Sure. So the Common Earth Gardens is a program of facilitating access to land for immigrants, refugees, and now we're opening it up to native-born people as well. We have about 350 families actively gardening on community garden plots around the city of Louisville, and we have 11 farm teams in a training program called the Incubator Farm Program. On land, on larger plots of land, and they are doing active marketing and selling their produce as CSAs and at farmers markets here in the city.
Wow. Did you say 150 families?
350 families.
350. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, this program started back in 2007 with a grant that my old friend Sherry Stanley wrote when she was a staff person at the Kentucky Office of Refugees, the RAP grant, R-A-P-P, Refugee Agricultural Production Program, a partnership program. And I was a consultant back then for a couple of years and then had other things to do. I wasn't involved in the program, but it continued. Catholic Charities took it over and it expanded. Today we have a little staff of about three or four, and we have graduates, our first graduates from the Incubator Farm Program, who are going to be graduated from the program this year. We're looking for new land opportunities for them. They are active marketers here in the city of their produce. And it's an amazing, when you think about how many people are being fed healthy food and the mental health benefits and other benefits of people able to enact their culture on the land. It's an extraordinary and beneficial program for the community.
And we should mention, my good friend Rachel Bruner is actually stepping down in her position as assistant director of Common Earth Gardens. So there is a job opportunity here for folks who are interested in doing work with immigrant farmers right here in the city. It's a pretty exciting job opportunity. And again, it's through the Catholic Charities is the place to go to learn more about it. The Archdiocese of Louisville, I believe, right?
Correct. And we also have another position for an educator on nutrition.
Oh,
that's
wow.
Also open at this time. So
wow. So it sounds like it's more than just about providing land.
Well, yeah. As most farmers know in the world, having land alone does not guarantee you're going to be successful. And for immigrants who have recently arrived in the United States, there's a huge learning curve for how to deal with the systems, the institutions, the rules and regulations, the lack of access, private property, the cost of land, the cost of everything. The Incubator Farm Program is a comprehensive training program where staff members accompany immigrants, refugee farmers. Actually, we call them international farmers because, you know, you may have come as a refugee, but you're not a quote-unquote refugee.
Mm.
You are an international farmer who is now here in the United States. It was a huge joy to me to come back into the circle of this community because I knew some of the folks, that I worked with back in 2008 and 2009 are still farming and are actually very successful farm marketers as well. And the reunions have been nonstop and wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, when we think about the context from which a lot of these folks are coming from, one advantage they have over a lot of folks from the U.S. is a more intimate relationship with the land. Maybe they're not all farmers, but it's probably closer to their heritage than many of us as we continue to lose farmers every day in the U.S., right? So this is a skill set, a knowledge base that they can bring with them to make a new life here in Louisville. But there's still tons to be learned, right? Whether it's just a different climate or think about like the market and how you market things in the United States, so different from a lot of the context these folks are coming from, right?
Right, yeah. And many, we were discussing, you know, in Maryland, their home countries, they would just take whatever surplus they had at a given moment, put it in sacks, put it on a mule or put it on the back of a motorcycle or rent some pickup truck transportation, go to the town where there's an open market, set up market and sell your produce. That's kind of the way it was done over there. But here, you know, you got to plan your crops out. You got to have a regular spot in a farmer's market where you've got to every day, every week have produce, you know, throughout the season. You have to abide by all the regulations and hygiene and food prep, food safety, and you have to be able to talk to the clients, give them recipes. So you have what's interesting is now with these folks who have been gardening and farming for the last 10, 12 years, they have a new generation of young adults who are their offspring, daughters and sons, who now are fluent in English. They're keen on social media and technology, and they are able to help their parents market their produce. So it's there's quite a lot of new opportunities for this community now with the growing new generation of adapted and sort of Americanized in a sense, modernized, very smart, very wonderful young adults who are coming up in these families. Yeah.
And talk to us about some of the crops they bring with them that they may be introducing us to here in Louisville.
Well, I have learned a number of new crops. Well, one thing was interesting before we get into the actual crops that they grow was how they could identify very valuable edible foods that we consider weeds, right?
Oh.
So in some of the gardens that back in 2008, I would notice like, oh, they're weeding around the weeds.
Native
native purslane, which most farmers would consider a weed in their vegetable patch. They were going, oh, why do I have to plant anything? I got nature, Mother Earth just gave me my crop here, so let me just weed it, you know, around it. In other words, so leave space so this purslane can really dominate the space for this lamb's quarters, which, by the way, the greens of the lamb's quarters, which is a very common weed here, are 50% more nutritious than kale.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, by weight, you know. So they've identified very high nutritious native weeds that they are also familiar with in their home countries. And they've like, well, why buy a seedling or a seed?
Yeah.
Mother Nature gives me my food straight up. So, but that's one thing one innovation that they have done. And the other is they've brought certain crops that have high medicinal value, such as the bitter melon, such as a plant, a woody, bushy plant that the Burmese have brought that has a very sour leaf that is extremely nutritious and delicious in soups and stews and is very drought hardy. It's a woody little bush with a deep taproot, so it's drought hardy. There are any number. I was just yesterday on the plot with our Kachin farmers. They are marketing at the Beachmont Farmers Market, and they were giving me to try some kind of water spinach.
It's
a delicious little green with a long, narrow leaf.
The Kachin from Southeast Asia?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And there's any number of greens that you might not be familiar with that are being grown by these farmers. Yeah.
While we're on that, somebody at Louisville Nature Center about a year ago, I mean, Louisville Nature Center is just not overrun, but there's this false nettle, and you have to worry about, you don't want to get stung by it. But you can pick it, and it's supposed to be really good as a green, very nutritious, like spinach or kale. But I mean, the false nettle is just everywhere at Louisville Nature Center, and I'm sure other places.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I love the part about weeding around the weeds. It's like Mark Shepherd said that, you know, farmers make two mistakes. They, or, you know, most farm conferences, you're trying to figure out how to grow what doesn't want to grow and kill what wants to grow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of the learning curve is that, you know, a lot of consumers of food here are not familiar and are kind of picky eaters. They don't want to try new things. So a lot of the, you know, international farmers have to realize, well, you know, what they want is lettuce and collards. Okay. So, you know, to grow more of that for the market. So they're learning, they're adapting to what the local tastes are, and that's natural and a good thing. And some of them are very keen marketers in that sense. Yeah. They're very observant of what people are buying, and they look at what people are buying at other from other farmers, and they say, oh, how can I get seeds for that? That kind of stuff, yeah.
And I love this idea of food as medicine, and I think that's something that folks from other cultures could really help us understand better. We tend to put it off in this box of like, it's homeopathy, or it's this separate pseudoscience, or maybe it's just about weeds, but it's more than that. It's a conception of eating healthy to stay healthy, which we are so far from here in Louisville, right? I'm sitting here on Broadway. I've got access to none of that medicine, right? But we could, and that's part of the vision of Common Earth Gardens, part of the vision of Sol, right, is to transform our urban landscape into a health-giving, sustaining landscape, right?
Yeah, you know, people of the land who work from the land, who are usually far from towns and cities, and they haven't been overcome by the propaganda about health and wellness that you need, like modern, like medicine, synthetic medicines, etc. They've always, for thousands of years, that's how human race has survived up till now, is, healing ourselves from what's available in our environment. And one of the crops that have been very important introduction is the bitter melon or bitter gourd. And Southeast Asians, Chinese, Middle Easterners, Africans are all familiar with this plant. And it's an extremely valuable medicinal plant. It looks like a cucumber, but it's rough on the edges. And it's extremely good for lowering blood pressure. I think there's a huge opportunity to make medicine out of this that people with high blood pressure could take without having to cook it. And during the winter, I think, so there's a lot of interesting opportunities. Some people just eat that fruit on a regular basis to control their high blood pressure. And it doesn't have any of the side effects of most blood pressure medicines that people are dependent on. It's also good for diabetes. And I was just in the garden with a woman, a local neighbor here, who's been helping with gardening with our community garden. And she says for the Chinese, bitter herbs and bitter plants like the bitter melon are beneficial. Every Chinese knows it. You want to eat bitter in summer because summer is hot and bitter is a cooling factor. And so just in general, the yin and yang theory is, I lived in China for 2 years and I absorbed a lot of the knowledge that Chinese shared with us about eating in season for the yin and yang to keep the temperatures, the cool and moist and hot and dry in balance at any given time of the year. And that's sort of like eating in season, but it's also knowledge of particular plants and things to eat at different times of the year. Yeah.
Is Common Earth Gardens a place folks can visit down on Miller's Lane or at least check out?
Yes, we're actually, now that the COVID protocols are relaxing a little bit, We are going to be organizing some volunteer days out at Miller's Lane at the incubator farm, which, by the way, is 3130 Miller's Lane. And it's a beautiful spread of incredibly beautiful plots of vegetables. We have an irrigation system, and drip irrigation has now been installed this year by a number of the farmers. It's got a wash station. It's a great place to hang out. We've got place to hang out. So volunteers are welcome to come and just do whatever's happening at that time on Tuesdays, starting a week from this coming Tuesday. We'll be having volunteers coming Tuesday evenings from 6 to 8.
Oh, okay. Tuesday, 6 to 8 p.m., starting on July 14th. Cool. And how big is this place, did you say?
Well, this is land that we rent, we leased from the MSD.
Yeah. It's,
and it is a huge expanse. But right now we have 11 plots that are about, let's see, I'd say about 50 by 150 feet each. Each of the farm teams have one or two of those plots. And we have farm teams from Somalia, from Burma, and who have passed and lived in other countries as well. We have one incubator farmer who's from Iraq, but we're working on digging a pond and starting an aquaculture project on his land out in Fairdale. And we have other new, a guy from Congo might be starting next year with us there at the incubator farm.
I think Justin said something about this earlier, but we, you know, when it comes to immigrants, I think in the mainstream of American culture, we're accustomed to think, oh, these are people who don't bring a lot of skills, but actually they bring a lot of skills in terms of growing food and so forth. And those are the skills that we need. They're skills that should be valued more. And so I'm just saying.
Yeah, you know, we made that very when COVID happened, and we were right away trying to be proactive. And Commonwealth Gardens came out with a strong statement under the banner of Catholic Charities, saying that, you know, farmers, gardeners are essential workers, should have the right to be out on their land, and also to take part in the farmers markets. And farmers markets are essential places, and as well, and cannot be discontinued. They are essential and absolutely necessary for our well-being, right, to have food to eat. And so these workers, yeah, they're all wearing masks, they're all up on the protocols, but they are essential workers. You know, I think being a farmer is like growing up in a musical family. A real true master of music usually grows up in a musical family with music around them, and they're learning it from the time they're little. I think farming is that level of skill as well. And just the other day, I was out there walking, and I was astonished. And one of the farmers, a woman from Somalia, about 60 years old, she had the most incredible cabbages, and they were already fully developed. And
wow.
I'm like, how the heck did you do this? You know, the skill level is quite extraordinary, and they wouldn't even be able to maybe tell you how they know it or what they know, but they know it. Yeah, they know they have those skills, and it's as I say, learned from working with the land from a young age, you know.
Well, one thing that as part of the climate report, I have had to develop my own opinion about how do we get off of fossil fuels. And it's not always the answer that you find in mainstream environmentalists, if there is such a thing. But, you know, I say there are certain things that can be reduced by 90%, including air travel, including cars, and including defense. And I include industrial agriculture in that. If we could just reduce industrial agriculture by 90%, that would free up so much land, so much expertise. It would maybe have an impact in bringing land prices to within affordable rates. But, you know, am I on the right track with that?
Absolutely. And actually, that's the goal of the whole international food sovereignty movement, to defend this model, the model of small scale, knowledge based, democratic process, democratic control of land and resources, the right of people to grow and eat the food that's appropriate to their culture, the right of small scale farmers to have the opportunity to not be evicted, to not be to have their land taken over by large-scale corporate-style agriculture, the right of them not to be dumped on by international trade, so-called free trade agreements, the right not to have their seeds stolen by the privatization of living things. So this is the big struggle. I would also add that if we were to repopulate a lot of the industrially worked lands of the earth, we would also be reforesting, and we would be restoring probably as much carbon as has been emitted into the air by fossil fuels in the last 40 or 50 years. That is, to my mind, one of the key solutions to mitigating and to adapting to climate change, is to repopulate the rural areas with small-scale farming that has enough margin of, that has enough support and margin of profitability, of well-being, economic well-being, that the farmers don't have to abuse the land in order to scratch a living from it.
Our guest today here on Truth to Power on Forward Radio, your community radio station, is Stephen Bartlett. I'm Justin Maugg, and Hart Hagen is with me here, too, in the virtual studio. We're talking about food, local food, international solidarity, and urban agriculture here today on the show. You can learn more about Stephen's work with Sustainable Ag of Louisville at salouisville.org, and you can check out the Common Earth Gardens at 3130 Miller's Lane with volunteers. Days starting next week on July 14th, Tuesdays 6 to 8 p.m. You also wanted to really stress that you're an active member of the Black Lives Matter movement. Connect for us what we're talking about here with both the international solidarity work, but the local food work and the agriculture work. Connect that. How do you connect that in your mind with what we hear on the streets, which is mostly about defund the police and police brutality, but protecting Black lives in general? Reflect on that for us, if you would.
Yeah, I think this moment is a moment of great awakening and consciousness raising for many, many people. And I think that even those who are on the front lines most impacted by the police violence and the horrific violence and killing that has happened for people, Black people and people of color, is also the knowledge, the understanding that this is an interconnected system, that the violence imposed by white supremacy is also related directly to the economic model that is dominating our society. Slavery itself was developed as an institution in order to develop the very basis for our capitalist system. I think a lot of people are getting that. For example, at Breonna Square, which used to be called Jefferson Square, the flower beds have now been planted in peppers, tomatoes, Swiss chard, all kinds of herbs, rosemary, and the place was planted heavily. And in a way, it's like, to me, that's a symbol of how these are connected, because we need to feed the most marginalized, the poor who have gone to Breonna Square to get food and housing. Homeless people have been coming to the square. These are connected, interconnected. The redlining of African American communities is the very same force that has pushed small farmers off the land. It's the same exclusionary marginalizing economic structure that's imposed by a white supremacist, hyper-capitalist system. So to me, this movement is like the movement for self-determination by African countries that were colonized. I feel this is a current anti-colonial, anti-racist, anti-police violence movement. Settler colonialism has been identified by many of the Black Lives Matter leaders and thinkers as one of the bases for the white supremacist system. And so I think this is the point of a spear that is much wider and much bigger. And I think people are beginning to get that. And So I see that. That's why I'm very committed to doing all I can to support the Black Lives Matter movement. Some of us were arrested last Monday in an action on the Second Street Bridge, doing civil disobedience and raising the banner for Breonna Taylor. I feel this is the point of a spear to transform our country. Yeah.
Steve, some people think race and class are separate things. And I think in our country, we're taught to think about race as a separate thing from class. But I think you're pointing to a system where race is used as a tool for capitalists to extract from everybody. Is that, am I on the right track with that?
Yes, I think what's often not understood by a lot of non-African-American or non-people of color individuals, melanin challenged, as they is that racism is like the twin brother or sister of capitalism, and because they were born together. Slavery required an ideology that could justify treating people in that manner. But that ideology has a life of its own. Mm. White supremacy, discrimination, and racial abuse of people of color comes from that very ideology that was required for people to stomach the idea of enslaving people, right? So that's how I see it connected, but it has a life of its own and has to be addressed for all the virulent aspects of it. Mm. You know, it could live on even without, an economic reason. You know, it can, in some sense, it's become its own monstrous ideology. So I think it has to be addressed as probably a primary problem, a primary thing to overcome in order for us to unite ourselves. It's not as easy as saying, oh, it's the same as class. You have to go deeper than that. While I was at the park, we had an interview. There was a crew that came in from DC, a hip hop crew, and they heard that I had been in the action. They wanted to interview me. And we got into a big discussion about how whites can deprogram themselves from the implicit biases that we absorb as part of just being in ordinary white culture. A lot of people think white culture or white, but it isn't. We grow up with all kinds of signals, all kinds of psychological understandings, peer shared and parental shared attitudes, and especially emotions, right? People who fear, when you're fearful of someone because of their color, that is transmitted. It's a contagious emotion that parents deliver to their children, that peers deliver to each other. I remember being in a white suburb of Long Island, New York, and thinking that it was dangerous in the city. Mm. That was just a common sort of feeling and information that was shared constantly. Mm-hmm. But I only realized the degree to how that functioned when we were hosts for African-American children from the city for 2 weeks out in our home. And as a result of those little black children playing with us and living with us, our whole family became ostracized from the whole neighborhood. The whole neighborhood banned their children from playing with us because we were with a black child playing. At that point, we had to decide. At that point, it was obvious to us, well, we are part of a small counterculture that does not approve of racism. But that wasn't enough to deprogram me. Mm-hmm. I had to live in Africa for a year and be the only white person for miles for a whole year to deprogram my fear. Mm-hmm. That was transmitted to me as a child just by living in a white neighborhood. You know, when I came back and I got lost in New York looking for a subway, I got off the wrong subway and I was in Harlem. And then I realized I am not afraid. And my lack of fear made it a perfectly safe place to be for me. Because if you're afraid of someone, that people smell that fear on you. And it's an insult. If someone comes to your neighborhood and they're afraid of you, you feel it. It's an insult. And it creates disharmony and distrust. And so fear that white people have of people of color that's taught in the culture has to be deprogrammed. And we had a discussion about how that could be done, and it's not easy, you know.
Yeah.
First, you need to train teachers to be deprogrammed themselves in order to find a method for training, for using in the schools, you know, to deprogram people. But I think integration and exposure. And I was saying, look, come on out. You should come out to one of the marches every white person should come out one of the Black Lives Matter marches and see that what you might have been afraid of is actually not to be afraid of, you know?
Steve, you mentioned settler colonialism. What is that, and how does that connect to what's going on now with the protests? And also, how does it connect to our food system?
Well, you know, in addition to slavery that was imposed here in the United States, before that was genocidal conquest of land and stripping of land from Native American peoples. So without that, I mean, that was the way in which we imposed ourselves and created settlements, right, here in the New World. And then, of course, that settler culture in the South took a turn toward plantation, large-scale plantations, which was an innovation to create monocultures at that time. In order to do that, they had to have a labor force. The indigenous people were dying off because of diseases and because of extermination and conquest. So they had to bring in Africans who had resistance to some of the diseases that were from the old world. And so they were brought enslaved, kidnapped, enslaved, and forced to work. In the North, you had families, sometimes with other indentured people, but mostly it was the family's labor that went into the farming in the North of the United States. Because there wasn't malaria. There's an interesting study. The Mason-Dixon line is the line in which malaria was prevalent to the South and not prevalent in the North. The English and European settlers up North couldn't have survived if there had been malaria up there too. By the way, the Europeans brought the malaria. It wasn't here before the Europeans came. It came from England. Malaria came to right? Jamestown colony from England. Yeah. Huh. didn't come from the tropics. It came from England. Yeah. So anyway, the colonial settler society, it's sort of like, think about South Africa as a good example. You had the English and the Dutch who took over the land of Africans in South Africa, right? And then it created a system of apartheid. Well, we had a system much like that, but it just wasn't called apartheid. Mm-hmm. African Americans have lost most of the land that they were able to acquire after the abolition of slavery, as they were driven because of Jim Crow and because of the horrors and lynchings, et cetera. They moved north where new industries were developing that could hire them, you know, that great migration. So, you know, there's a lot to say about the history of the United States and how settler colonialism was the basis for that whole system that was established here. Yeah.
Well, and it makes me think about the level of trauma that exists in this nation that most white folks are able to forget about or even celebrate that period with Confederate flags and things like that. That blows my mind. But I'm thinking about the trauma that still exists within the Black community and how that translates to their thinking about agriculture, because this trauma was done in the fields. And I can easily imagine how that would make Black folks in the U.S. today not want to come anywhere near a field. have you encountered that or have any thoughts on that, Stephen?
I think there's a lot of that. But there's also a lot of that among, I think there was also trauma for small scale white farmers as well. Mm. A lot of people fled the farm because of the harsh marginalized situation, the harsh labor, the bankruptcy that was hanging over their heads, losing the land under indebtedness, the young people being forced to work, you know, and by very stressed out, traumatized farmer parents. And they also don't want to see a hoe. So I don't think it's just an African-American phenomenon, the flight from, you know, farm labor and stuff like that. But yet today in this food movement, we have these fantastic, beautiful, very visionary African-American activists leading people back to the land. And it's a very important part of our movement. The U.S. Food Sovereignty Alliance is right now working on expanding the representation at every level to include much more people of color, to change our culture so that our spaces are welcoming toward a diverse group of people, whether urban or rural, people of color, indigenous, et cetera. So this is, yeah, this is an ongoing work that we need to do and continue to do. It's very, I'm glad that you brought that up, Justin. Yeah.
Well, one thing we need to do is change the economics of farming. And I read a book called Civilized to Death by Christopher Ryan. And he talks about the NPP, the narrative of perpetual progress. So we're taught that, you know, we Americans, we're the richest, therefore we're the best, and we're the result of all this progress. And one thing that I was taught in school that represents progress is people migrating from the farm to the city or from the rural to the urban. And I no longer think that's progress. For one thing, it's something that was forced by the economics of the situation, because the owners of the bankers and the other owners of capital were able to change the economics so as to always, push the small farmers out of business. And then, we end up with, more and more urbanization, fewer and fewer people farming more and more land. And when you mechanize everything, the work that used to be done by people is now done by pesticides and is done by fertilizers and is done by big machines that are themselves sold and controlled by monopolies. Mm-hmm. So and then Vandana Shiva is talking about how we need more people to care for the land. We don't need less people to care for the land. We need more. We need people who can distinguish between a weed and a wildflower, and people who can distinguish between maybe an invasive weed and something that might be edible. But we need and there's nothing that should be undignified about farming, but we have made it. We have this narrative about farming being undignified. Like Wendell Berry will talk about people saying, "I'm just a farmer," like that's some kind of lower status.
Thank you, Hart. Yeah. Part of our work is to raise up and just give credit where change the image. I mean, it started to change a little bit, that farmers, local farmers are kind of raised up a little bit as heroes, bringing in the healthy food in the middle of the food deserts and all that, and this horrible industrial food system we have. But the actual work of farming is not romantic. It's a lot of hard, very hard work. And but people, instead of going to the spa, they could be hoeing their crops. They could be, walking their fields. They could be digging their garden beds. I enjoy actually. I mean, I've never been a member of a spa, but I think everyone should have their hand in agriculture in this world. And I agree with you that it's a lot of people have forgotten how to do all that work, but that's where we come in. Those of us who know how, we're now being called all the time to help teach others how to do this. It's our past, and I think it's going to be our future as small scale people of the land. The word peasant was denigrated in our vocab, in our dictionaries, right? By the way, it was taught in school that you're just a peon of a feudal lord or something. But peasants just means people of the land, and I'm proud to have some knowledge and be in contact with the land. And just yesterday, I was, sometimes people say they're always comparing their technologies. Like people who use the long-handled hose thought they were superior to the Somalis who use short-handled hose. I just saw a demonstration that small-handled hoe can actually work much faster than a long-handled hoe. Then you have someone who's skilled in it. And I'm like, dang. Once I went up against a weed whacker who's trying to clear a fence with a gas-powered weed whacker.
Important work right there.
That had a special blade put on it. But I, with a machete, with a well-sharpened machete, I wiped him out. He couldn't compete with me. If you have good knowledge of a simple technology, sometimes it's the superior technology, but people just don't realize that. Instead of having a noisy weed whacker that's always breaking, you have to keep changing the thing. you have a good machete and some good skills, you don't need to bother with that, you know. I think I got off the topic, but
that's what we do.
Steve, once when we were talking, you talked about the simpler the tool, the more sophisticated is the knowledge, the skill of using that tool. Like you were talking about somebody using an axe like it was Michelangelo or something, just all the different speeds and angles that you can swing that axe and create something with it.
Yeah. Now, I think that was coined. I don't know if Wendell Berry coined it, but he was the first one I heard saying the simpler the technology, the greater the skill or knowledge required to use it. And so when you simplify, when you make technology more sophisticated, you dumb down the user of that technology, right? So like mechanic, think of a car mechanic now. Car mechanic, what do they do now? They hook up your car to a computer and it tells you, you just got to replace this part. It doesn't tell you how to fix the part. If you didn't have a store you could order that part with, which costs a lot of money, by the way,
right.
You would have to fix, you know, you'd have to, in the old days, like, so technology that was built before like 1960s, 1970s, you could actually fix it even with, you can actually make tools or make parts for it, you know, but with modern cars, you can't do that. So it takes it into the hands of the corporation away from the local practitioner who used their knowledge and skills and experience with those parts to fix those machines, right?
Steve, you've been around a lot of places around the world, China, Dominican Republic, Venezuela, Africa, and I'll be darned if I didn't forget what I was going to ask, but it's something to do with nutrition. When I think of nutrition, or when I think of our food system, I think of something that delivers poor nutrition. Mm. We have this, you know, cheap food policy that's all about cheap food, but yet it's poor nutrition. So if Steve Bartlett was king of the world or king of Louisville, you know, we can dream. So if Steve Bartlett were king of Louisville, what would you change about our food systems so as to deliver better nutrition and maybe be fairer to farmers?
Well, after abolishing the monarchy, I would, so that I don't lose my head, you know, I would,
this is enlightened self-interest here.
No, I mean, basically, yeah, you know, just look where you are and look around you, you know, see what the resources are right at hand. I think we need to have equitable access, which means to each according to their need. If I need X amount of land to produce and I have enough capacity, strength, energy to work that land, then I should have access to that amount of land. Right now, everything is private property. The whole idea of private property was the doom for native peoples across the world when it was imposed by Europeans. And that came out of a feudal lord mentality, that the feudal lord was the owner of the land and then extracted your labor to get to work that land. And then that became capitalistic.
And the commons are still being enclosed.
So I think I would advocate for a radical redistribution of commonly held lands and maybe an agrarian reform, land reform program. Mm-hmm. I would advocate for water to be subsidized. We have a water company here, but it's pseudo government under governmental regulation. I would say the government have to nationalize that, take that over as an autonomous good, common good. I think water then should be distributed again according to people's needs and what they can do with that water. Hmm. I think right now a lot of what's holding a lot of farmers, gardeners here in the city back is the cost of water. Hmm. The cost of water is almost prohibitive in some instances. So the common goods, seeds, land, water, all those common issues, we should find a way to make them accessible to as many people as need and want to have access to those resources. I think that would transform our, and that brings what the indigenous people call autonomy. Autonomy means you have access to what you need. It means you have control over your own production and your own consumption. And I think autonomy is the watchword. It's the principle that we should all consider in any given moment. How much autonomy are people being given? How much self-determination do they have over their lives in terms of producing and providing what they need and their own family well-being and health, et cetera? Yeah.
In order to do that, you would have to kind of redistribute intergenerational wealth. It's like the means of production are owned by a small class of people, many of whom have inherited that wealth and privilege. And you're talking about, you know, empowering people. You're saying that equal rights doesn't just mean the freedom to not be harassed by the state, which we don't have that either. But you're saying that equal rights involves having some economic means to utilize our shared resources like water and land.
Yes, you know, most of the religious traditions of the world have spoken without any ambiguity on this issue. You know, in the Christian tradition, every 49 years, all debts, the Jubilee means that all debts have to be annulled. All land that had been taken up in that time had to be returned to its original inhabitants. You know, in Islam, usury or requiring interest payments on loans, etc., is considered a sin. It's considered a sin against God. Those traditions teach us what we need to know about how to undo intergenerational wealth. You know, in Native Americans, in some traditions, when a person dies who may have accumulated some, you know, more land and goods than others, that cannot be inherited. It has to be redistributed among the collective of the tribe. So I think we have those lessons from other cultural traditions and from our own religious traditions on why that's necessary and why it's essential.
You know, I've been trying to develop a list of things that local government can do to, you know, change the food system or whatever else we need here. And I'm kind of accustomed to thinking that, oh, such and such a thing as state policy or federal policy. But what you said about water is something that local government can do. Local government can set up a system so that people who legitimately need water can get a coupon or a ration ticket. And some people are afraid of that because, oh, we don't want to ration, but there is rationing. We have rationing. You know, your ability to pay for water is the limitation on your ability to use water. So,
yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's worth thinking about. And I think the Food in Neighborhoods organization, if people are interested, we're working on some of those policy issues, access to land, vacant properties, the issue of water and how it can be provided with greater access to people who need it, for whom it's prohibitive, the cost of water. So these are some of the issues. Recently, the Metro Council passed a budget that had some very good items in it. I sent a message to Bill Hollander, who's been pushing some of that, approving of some of the things that were put into the new budget that the Metro Council either passed or is considering passing, including a big chunk of money for the cooperative grocery here in Louisville, which would be a big advance in terms of marketing locally produced foods and providing foods for all who need it on a sliding scale basis, you know. So I think it's worth looking into what's happening. And that budget comes out of the push now on the Black Lives Movement. All these changes are coming because of this strong, powerful movement from below that is pushing people to rethink everything. And I think that we need to keep pushing and keep expanding that debate. And I think our Metro Council, some of them are really seeing, they're really on board with what's happening, and they're trying to do the right thing. So we need to have their backs in that. Yeah.
And I just want to point out too that people can join the Louisville Community Grocery right now, and we need people to join. I'm a proud member, but we're only about, you know, 10-15% of the way to where we need to be to have enough members to open the store. And so this has been like a 5-year organizing effort that has finally gotten over a big push now of getting a big chunk of money, but that's not all we need. We need members too. So people can learn more and join at LouisvilleCommunityGrocery.com. We're nearing the end of our time. We got 10 more minutes left. You've shared a little bit of your vision for a more just and sustainable Louisville. And certainly food is at the heart of it in a lot of ways of that we think about it. What's it going to take to get there? I mean, there's all these sort of different projects happening, but how do we organize around these issues and still do justice to things like Black Lives Matter?
Thank you, Justin. It's a good question, really good question. And I think what I have understood in my years working in different social movement spaces is that when the people most impacted have the leadership position, the movement becomes strongest.
Mm.
So those people have a lot of skin. They have all their skin in the struggle. You know, it's not an NGO that has staff that's willing to provide staff time for some kind of effort, right? Some kind of advocacy effort. These are people literally whose lives depend on the social movement, being successful. So I think, I believe that we need to support those spaces. I think that's where the power is. And to me, to my mind, forget about the NGO, what you would think of as a director of an NGO. You got to think of yourself as part of a social movement, not just someone looking after to a particular little organization. Look at the big picture. I have a friend now in Miami, Freddy Peralta. He's been arrested 7 times already because he understands that this is the point of a spear that is huge, that can transform this country. The issue may be police violence, and it's a crucial issue. It's absolutely crucial. But behind it lies the whole country awakening to the situation that we're in. And I think making those connections, I think we need to think in terms of social movements. We need to think in terms of real power, that no president, look, we got one of the most right-wing presidents now, and yet we're passing budgets that nobody could have ever foreseen. They just cut $1 billion for the New York City Police Department.
Wow.
Budget, $1 billion. We're seeing changes that nobody could ever have anticipated under a right-wing white supremacist president, right? So that shows you that power truly does come from the grassroots, and taking over the streets, showing the power, showing the support, the massive support for this movement. It's what we have to contribute to. It's what we have to understand is the real change maker. So, you know, those of us who have other knowledge and other, we're positioned to work on water subsidies, to work on land access. We need to connect our struggles with that larger social movement. I think we have to think in terms of social movements. Learn our history from the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, the abolition movement. They succeeded because they got masses of people behind them. And that's what we're doing. That's what's happening right now in the United States. To ignore that, to just work on your little issue in a silo, is to miss a great opportunity. We need
working
to have
on a little back. Issue in your little silo is the American way.
Yeah. We're busting it wide open. No, I'm the last person in the world who wants to give the Trump administration any credit, but I will say this. The level of extremity of the Trump administration, and I would trickles down to Kentucky in terms of what the Bevin administration did too, has just ripped the mask right off of America and made it so plain to everyone what's actually going on here, that it has mobilized us. It has woken so many. But you're absolutely right, Stephen. That means we've got to organize and continue in solidarity and create this new world together that we want, rather than waiting for the next election, I would say.
You got to do that as a tactical maneuver, whatever you think is the tactical best way to do it in terms of elections. But the real thing is acting on what you've seen and cannot unsee.
Yes.
Well, the last environmental president was Richard Nixon. He signed the EPA right. into law. He signed the Clean Water Act, the Fish and Wildlife Endangered Species Act. So, you know.
Weak politicians can be pushed to do stuff, you know. Hopefully that will be the case with a Biden, for example, you know. I feel like he's a weak individual who could go the way the wind blows, you know. Up till now, he's gone with the centrist neoliberal winds. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe if he's elected, he could be blown the other way. He could be blown left, you know, against his will, you know.
But that's going to require people power, because the money power is still stacked up against us, no matter who's in office, right? So we need to balance that all that power, that money, with people power demanding change and greater opportunity for the masses, rather than the continual concentration of wealth. It's just gotten so extreme. You keep mentioning about this point of a sphere. I mean, that's, to me, in my mind, that makes me think of the inequality in America and how pointed that's become.
Besides, we like violent metaphors here on Forward Radio.
But simple technology, a spear is a simple technology.
Right.
Well, we're nearing the end of our time, Stephen. Anything, boy, you've mentioned so many different projects. I almost wish there was a home base to send everybody to. But any last things you want to share with our listeners, things coming up in the community people should be aware about, or resources online that you want to share? This is your last opportunity here.
So, well, I would recommend looking at some of the live feeds from the daily activities at Brianna Square. There's a number of good live streamers, Maxwell Mitchell, Jason Downey, John Domain, Attica Scott when she's out on the square. They have wonderful commentary. You can see what's really happening. A key element in keeping the interest, in keeping people aware of what's happening in these struggles, are these live streams. And so I would recommend once in a while going on a live stream, Facebook live stream with one of these individuals. And then join an organization and become part of that work, you know, do something, but keep that social movement lens, you know.
Well, I honor you for always doing that, Stephen, and always helping us do that. It's a part of every talk I hear you give. It's at the heart of it. And, you're so on message with it. My goodness, you should be a politician. No, I love that you're not. You're the most genuine guy I know, and that's really valuable in these days.
My big innovation was when we were locked up in the jail Monday night, was we created out of the blankets and hygiene kits, we created a chess set that we played a number of very dramatic chess games in.
And then we were like, sneezed, and that was the end of that.
That's so cool.
They couldn't break us. We had chess. Yeah.
Right.
That's awesome. All right. We are out of time here on Truth to Power. My name is Justin Mogg. I'm host of Sustainability Now, and I want you to tune in to the show every Monday at 6 p.m., midnight, and then 10 a.m. Tuesday. Coming up this week, I've got an exciting conversation with some other Forward Radio programmers, Brian Barnes and Patty Payette, hosts of Critical Thinking for Everyone. I've been wanting to have them on my show for a long time. So we talk about sustainability and critical thinking. Hart Hagen, a host of Let's Talk and the Climate Report every day at 7. Anything coming up you want to promote?
We're always talking about the untold history of the United States. This is a one-man war against ignorance of United States history.
I love it. So join that movement. It continues every day here on Forward Radio at 7. Again, Stephen Bartlett, thank you so much for joining us today on Truth to Power.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Stay tuned, friends. Lots of great stuff coming up on Forward Radio, and we'll be back in your ears again in 1 week's time.